This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Britain's vote last week to leave the European Union has a lot of people up in arms trying to figure out what is going to happen next. This vote exposed some deep divisions within Britain that are really concerning, that it's hard to see the British people overcoming. We're going to talk with Richard Palmer over in the UK about the implications of Britain being a house divided. This past Sunday, Israel and Turkey overcame recent tensions to forge a deal that normalizes relations between them. We're going to talk with Brent Noctegal over in Jerusalem about this deal, why it was struck, whether Israel can actually trust it, and what we can expect to happen between these two countries in the end. In America last week, the Supreme Court ruled on the constitutionality of President Barack Obama's executive action in 2014, suspending immigration enforcement for millions of illegal immigrants. They split right down the middle, 4-4. We're going to talk with Andrew Miller about what this says about the state of American governance today, the role of the executive branch, the legislative, the judicial, and about the rule of law in America today. And I'll conclude today by talking about how America's and Britain's greatest days lie yet ahead. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. It has been fascinating watching the fallout to last week's referendum in the United Kingdom on EU membership and Britain's decision to get out of the European Union. That decision has rocked global markets. It's caused a great deal of consternation among the political class in Britain and in Europe. And it has a lot of people trying to make sense of what is going to happen next. What are the ramifications of this decision? To talk about some of these ramifications and some of the chaos that has followed that decision, we have trumpet writer Richard Palmer via Skype from our office in Britain. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So from our perspective over here across the pond, it seems as though the sky is falling in Britain. Can you give us an update of the latest from over there?
Yeah, it seems a bit like that from over here as well. The Prime Minister has resigned. The Labour Party is descending into civil war. The pound is plummeting. And then to add insult to injury, Britain just got kicked out of the Euro 2016 soccer championships by Iceland. Even our football manager has resigned. So there is very much a sense that just the wheels are coming off everything right now.
Well, I imagine that the last thing that you mentioned is probably the worst of all of those things to a lot of Brits.
I think it is the one, yes, that has got the most people emotional.
So it seems that one of the big stories that has really come out of this is just how much division there is within Britain between these two camps. There was this sense of like, what just happened? I'm living in a nightmare among those who wanted to remain. And really like a lack of comprehension that this could even happen. Maybe you could just talk about that, just what we have learned about Britain from what happened here.
Right. Well, what we have learned about Britain here, and I think that gets to the heart of the kind of the chaos that we see going on, is you have something that's unexpected, something that's maybe not even quite a crisis, and everything falls to pieces. It has exposed a major, major weakness in just about all of Britain's leadership. I think it's not necessarily that leaving the European Union or the Brexit vote has caused everything to fall apart, but it's more the fact that Britain's leadership could not cope with something unexpected. And it's that it's exposed a weakness in Britain's leadership. And I think even if you look at, for example, the decline of the pound, it bears that out. It sank very quickly on Friday as the Brexit vote was announced. The financial markets were very surprised. By about mid-morning, though, it had bounced back up a little ways and had stabilized. And it wasn't until Monday morning after the weekend when it started to sink in, okay, nobody's really got a clue what they're doing here, that it sank even further. And so, you know, you've got within, say you take all the different camps, you've got the governing Conservative Party that was going for an in vote. They don't seem to have any plan for Brexit. Mr. Cameron has resigned. So that puts just about all of the government now, everything is on hold. Nobody knows who's going to be in charge. Meanwhile, the Leave vote, there was quite a dramatic interview on TV a day or two ago with one of where they were one of the journalists there was talking about a conversation that he had with one of the, an MP in the Leave camp. And they said, well, what was your plan for post-Brexit? And he said, well, our plan, we didn't have a plan. Those guys over at Downing Street, they should have had a plan. And I think there's good reason for that. The reason is the Brexit campaign was rather a loose amalgamation of people that all wanted Britain out of the EU, but they didn't have a shared vision for what would happen afterwards. And so they just kind of ignored the afterwards scenario and just focused, okay, well, first things first, let's just focus on getting Britain out of the EU. We can all agree on that. Right. And then finally, the Labour Party, I think 35 minutes ago from when we're recording this right now, they finished their, they finished up their vote of no confidence in their leader, Jeremy Corbyn. That the results of that will be published later today, but it looks very much like they will vote that they have no confidence in their leader. They're then going to start what probably looks less like a leadership contest to replace Jeremy Corbyn and more like a civil war, because just about the entire Labour Party now want Jeremy Corbyn to go, and he's sitting there and absolutely refusing to budge. His about, I think, two-thirds of his cabinet has resigned, and he's staying put. So you've got the government is headless right now, and they're not, there's not going to be a new prime minister or the replacement for Mr. Cameron until September. Nobody's taking any decisions there. The Leave camp is now divided. They're not going to be able to do anything. And Labour is in civil war. They're not going to be able to do anything. And so this kind of leads to this picture of just utter chaos.
Brett Stevens of the Wall Street Journal made an interesting point in his column this past Monday. He was talking about a lot of the problems that plague Britain today. They are homegrown problems. They are British-made problems. They were not imposed by the EU. He talks about exorbitant tax rates. He talks about how energy prices have jumped massively, the problems with the National Health Service and so on. But he says, if the result of Brexit is to force London to dial down its own big state tendencies, so much the better. The likelier result is that the next prime minister will have to spend his political capital trying to keep the United Kingdom together and hoping a Brexit-related recession isn't pinned on him. American conservatives who think Brexit will pave the way for the return of Margaret Thatcher's spirit may find themselves disappointed when the ghost of Ted Heath shows up instead. It seems like that is a very likely scenario, that to have someone step into this breach and really chart a positive course forward for the nation is going to be extremely difficult, given the kinds of divisions that you're describing.
Yes, I do think leaving the EU is a necessary step for some kind of, say, new Margaret Thatcher to emerge. I mean, Michael Gove, who is probably the most prominent of the kind of small state politicians and probably one of the most capable politicians in Britain, you know, he was constantly trying to do things in the direction that Brett Stevens would want, small state, Margaret Thatcher-type direction, and getting blocked by the European Union. So Britain had to leave the EU to make a new Margaret Thatcher-type possible. But, and he's exactly right, there isn't anybody up there really who can step forward. I mean, there's no eloquent orator. There's nobody that can just put forward a vision for this is what the United Kingdom should be now. And you're right, there are so many different divisions as well, different divisions between parties. I mean, if you look at the number of Labour Party people who have been talking about the Conservatives as if they're just the epitome of evil and are doing everything that they can because they want poor children to suffer. And then you've got differences now within the different party groups. It does make it hard for anything to happen.
It seems as though there have been a lot of people who have been making comparisons between what's happening in Britain and certain realities within the American electorate as well. And there are, say, even broader trends that are happening in other nations as well, with populist uprisings and so on. And this kind of disenfranchisement with the ruling class and the establishment, and really kind of we're going to take power back to ourselves. this kind of a movement. One thing that I think really is probably a very apt comparison is we see the same kinds of divisions within the American electorate being exposed by this present presidential campaign, where it's almost like the divisions that you see within the populace are getting wider all the time. And even when, say, you know, something tragic happens like the Orlando shooting, it doesn't unite people in common cause. It actually causes more division because the response to that is so disparate among different segments of the populace. It seems like the divisions that you see within Britain, it's the same kind of thing where it's this entrenchment into separate camps and trying to kind of look after their own interests rather than really saying, you know, we need to unite behind a common cause. They were talking about this being Independence Day. Just thinking about, say, you know, if you hearken back to the American Revolution, there was a strong unity among Americans that we were going to make this, you know, departure from Britain. Whereas in Britain, there's none of that kind of commonality.
Right. And just to maybe try and put some of the divisions into context with America, in some ways, the Brexit vote was won by a coalition of Bernie Sanders supporters, Donald Trump supporters, and Ron Paul supporters. It was a very disparate group. If they had anything in common, it was kind of an anti-elitism. And meanwhile, the kind of the Hillary Clinton type and the Republican establishment type forces were for remaining in the European Union. So you're getting an increasing division, but then also just a multiplication of fault lines, left against right, elites against non-elites. And it's very hard to bring together even enough of those different camps to make 50%. And Brexit, the Brexit supporters managed to do that for just the vote, and it lasted for the vote. And now it's already falling apart with Nigel Farage starting to attack Boris Johnson and over exactly the post-EU relationship, the post-Brexit relationship that Britain will have with the EU.
You talked about the eloquent orator. That's a reference to the prophecy in Isaiah chapter 3, where it specifically talks about, in the context of end-time Israel, of which Britain is part, the loss of strong leadership and just what a curse this is on the nation. There it specifically talks about the removal of strong, capable leaders of every type, the judge, the war-making leaders, the eloquent orators. And really, we are witnessing that scenario play out in Britain today.
Right. I mean, when was the last time that anybody really, or that either nation, had a leader that could paint a picture of what they wanted the country to look like and rally people behind it? Maybe Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher would be the closest to that. But if you look at all of Britain's leadership since then, it's not been about that. They've not even tried to do that. It's been with both Mr. Tony Blair and Mr. Cameron, you know, the kind of the two longer serving prime ministers. It's just been about trying to hold the center ground and try and make sure that enough people do not disagree with you that you don't get booted from office. And it's all just been about staying in the middle and being the consensus candidate. And so we've kind of lost even the skill of being able to paint a vision of this is where we should go. Let's move there.
And Stephen Fleury made that point on the Trumpet Daily radio show earlier this week about just drawing attention to that resignation speech that David Cameron gave when he was enumerating the successes of his prime ministership. Some of those were things that really should not be sources of pride on his part. He's talking about things that really reflect weakness of leadership and really are bringing some of these curses on Britain.
Right. I saw a headline. It's something like David Cameron doesn't want to be remembered for the referendum. He wants to be remembered for homosexual marriage. And that's exactly how politics works these days. I think Tony Blair, Mr. Blair, called it triangulation. If you're a conservative minister, you pick a few key policies to try and appeal to the left. If you're a Labour minister, you try and pick some right wing policies and hold the center that way. Labour, obviously, they've kind of, the grassroots have quite comprehensively rejected that. But you do see the same thing in the US if you start to look at some of I mean, you see Republican leaders doing exactly the same thing over there as well, saying, okay, well, we need to give up on the quote unquote fight on homosexual marriage. We've lost that. Let's support it now and move on to other things.
Abraham Lincoln famously said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand," quoting Jesus Christ, obviously. And, you know, you do really fear for the future, both of America and Britain, seeing these kinds of deep chasms among the people, and just how vulnerable this makes both of our nations to major problems, and other nations recognizing those kinds of divisions and recognizing those vulnerabilities and stepping into the breach to take advantage of the weakness within these nations. You can look at an event like Brexit, obviously very dramatic, obvious fulfillment of prophecy, but seeing the leadership vacuum within both of these nations, seeing the divisions within these countries, really in a lot of ways is just as significant, if not as dramatic, but in terms of the effect on their future, just as significant.
Right. And if you look at, obviously, it's not just Britain and America in a lot of ways that have these divisions. Europe has them too. They're also having these populist uprisings. They also have a kind of liberal elite that absolutely despise everything that these populists stand for. I mean, look at Austria, where you had that the Freedom Party got nearly half the vote in the vote for the presidency. And just about all the intelligentsia of Austria, the people writing newspapers, absolutely despised that party. So there's a lot of division there as well. But then, as you say, the key difference there is leadership. We know that, you know, the Bible tells us for Britain and for America, God says he's taken away those leaders. Meanwhile, it also prophesies for Europe that there is coming a charismatic leader who is going to be able to rally the people behind them. So I think that accentuate or emphasizes one of the key differences in these countries is leadership. Now, I think there is a certain amount of difference in terms of the type of the division, and it does seem that Britain and America are probably more divided than Europe. But Europe hasn't escaped these problems, and it's the fact that we're looking for a strong leader there that probably makes the biggest difference.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. We'll definitely be watching for that. And really, the split between the future of America and Britain and that of Europe is profound. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's working on an article on this subject, and you can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Richard, this is great stuff. We will continue to follow this subject, and we appreciate you illuminating our minds on the subject.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
For years, the relationship between Turkey and Israel has been a major pillar in maintaining peace in the Middle East. But in recent years, as Turkey has become radicalized under the leadership of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, that relationship has really suffered, and particularly a few years ago in some events that really split the two countries. But this past Sunday, Israel and Turkey struck a deal, and this has pretty significant security and economic implications for the region. Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall has written an article about this subject, and we're connected with him via Skype from our office in Jerusalem. Hello, Brent.
Hello. How you doing?
Doing very well. Good to hear from you. Maybe you can just start by telling us why the change in heart in these two countries that have really been at odds with one another recently.
Yeah, the change of heart is probably the biggest story behind this, I think. What brought the two nations to the negotiating table. For the past, I don't know, it's been probably about 6 years since diplomatic relations have been broken off. Since the incident when the Turks, they tried to break the siege on Gaza, as they call it, by sending down a flotilla. A lot of people will probably remember that. And then the Israeli commandos, to stop those boats from coming through, boarded one of the vessels and ended up being attacked. And then in retaliation, they killed about 9 of those people who were Turkish citizens. So ever since that time, diplomatic ties have pretty much been broken off. But there has been a push over the past 3 years, it seems. It kind of started in 2013 that they wanted to, at least from Turkey's side, they wanted to, and Israel's side, they wanted to normalize relations. But then it looks like the situation for Erdogan has got to the point where he needs friends, he needs some allies, he needs people to work with in the region, and he's feeling so isolated that he decided to agree upon normalizing relations with the Israelis. So it mostly came from a change of perspective from him, as what that's what I wrote in the article, and it's also what a lot of other commentators have said, considering that the demands that he had for normalizing the relationship between Israel and Turkey, the main demand was that they would end the Gaza siege or Gaza blockade, that the Israeli Navy would not enforce a blockade of all ships coming towards the Gaza coast. That's what Erdogan wanted 3 years ago.
Which was a really unfair demand. Even the UN had said that this was illegal for Israel to do for its own security.
Right. The Palmer report came out, and that was done by the UN, which basically looked at the incident when the flotilla came down and deemed that Israel was well within its rights to do what it did and that it was a lawful blockade. So Prime Minister Netanyahu did not want to give up that. He realized that if he did give up that, then the Hamas terrorists in the Gaza Strip could have access to a lot of arms, free access. I mean, Israel couldn't really police it, of arms coming into the Gaza Strip. So he could not let that happen. And Erdogan said originally, well, if you don't let that happen, we can't normalize. We can't have an arrangement between our countries.
So really an untenable demand, but now his tone has changed.
Yeah, his tone has changed a lot. And even over the past few months, you kind of saw his rhetoric was a little bit toned down, but when he's referring to the Jews and the Israelis, he didn't blame as many things on in his own country as Jewish influenced events. Whenever he had some type of opposition, he blamed it was Jewish infiltration before. He stopped on that. So you could kind of see that something was coming up. But I think, and even as I bring out in the article, the timing behind this deal is extremely significant, indicating that he really does feel like he has lost some of the power that he had maybe a few years ago. And Israel, a relationship with Israel economically is one way to get that. We, even a few hours after it broke that they were going to have this deal, he issued an apology. Erdogan did to the Russians. He wrote them a letter and said, I apologize for shooting the Russian jet out of the sky. And that has, over the last day or two, it seems warmer ties are beginning to be brought about between Moscow and Istanbul or Ankara, I guess, now as well.
More so signs that he really wants to improve his position with other nations.
Right, he's backed into a corner. Like people know, Turkey's situated right in the middle of the world. It's mainly a transit state between East and West, between Asia and Europe. A lot of energy pipelines go through there. So they really need to have somewhat cordial relationships with those people surrounding them. And the Syrian civil war hasn't done a lot to help their Turkey's southern border. They've got the Kurds in the east that are kicking up a fuss. Their relationship with Iran has deteriorated a lot. Turkey's has, and they used to do a lot of trade with Iran because they're on opposite sides of the Syrian civil war. And then when they took down the Russian jet and they did not apologize, then the Russians came on strong. They ensured that a lot of agricultural exports that normally go to Russia were stopped. Russia pretty much banned any of its citizens from traveling down for tourist reasons down into Turkey as well. So they were really feeling the pinch over the past 6 months. And
that a man of Erdogan's ilk would be taking this kind of a conciliatory tone toward these other nations, because you have to think that this is pretty tough for somebody like him. But let's just talk about the terms of the deal. How is it that reconciling with Israel helps Turkey? What exactly does it mean? The normalization of relations between these two countries, how does it benefit them? What are the ramifications?
Right. It doesn't seem like on the surface, like right away, day one, we know how it's going to benefit Turkey. There is a lot of discussion about Israel's gas fields and that they've recently discovered off the coast of Israel, and Turkey possibly being a transit point for them, buying up Israeli gas. Turkey wants to diversify its gas right now. So there's talk of that, and even Netanyahu kind of spoke about that today or yesterday. But Turkey hasn't said too much how it intends to gain from that. But obviously, there's going to be an economic windfall between the two nations as trade will increase. And then I think also there might have been some pressure upon Turkey from Russia and from the United States to try and normalize relations with Israel as well. I wouldn't be surprised if in another couple of weeks we look back on this moment and see that Russia was actually behind a lot of these movements, because they've been talking a lot with Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu's talked with Putin for 4 times in the past year. And at the same time, we can see that Russia is so bogged down in Syria that they would want Turkey to help them out and maybe finding a solution in Syria. So economically, I would say, would be the biggest windfall for Erdogan as far as his relationship goes with Israel, because they'll have another trading partner. But I wouldn't be surprised if he was being pressured to do this as well.
It's interesting to look at this from Israel's perspective, and I'm trying to understand why Netanyahu would make this deal. In a lot of ways, you know, there's not a lot going right for Israel with their relationships with other nations these days. And for them to try to make this deal with really a major military power in the region, you could see that there would be some benefits there. But there's also a whole lot that should give Israel concern about having a relationship with Turkey.
Yeah, that is the case. I know over the past 6 months, Israel has expended a concerted effort to try and bring a number of Arab allies on board through the Middle East if they could. They've had overtures towards Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and Turkey could be seen in that light. Netanyahu came and talked about this deal, and he said that he's trying to create islands of stability throughout the Middle East, and that is predicated upon Israel being able to have strong relations, or relations at least, with some of these Middle Eastern countries. And they have gone out of their way to do that over the past 6 months. With Turkey, though, it really seems like they don't have much to go on that this is going to end up as a positive in the end, because of Erdogan's nature, because of the highly Islamist society that exists inside Turkey that is vehemently anti-Semitic. Most of the population, you know, there've been a number of studies over it in the past few years, and the anti-Semitic acts, as well as how the people feel about the Jews, has been going up. So Erdogan in his rhetoric does perfectly illustrate what the feeling is on the ground in Turkey as well. Not everyone's an anti-Semite, but there is a strong feeling there of that. So is it good for Netanyahu to have relations with people that don't like them and are willing and happy to see Israel fall into harm's way if Turkey didn't need Israel like it needs it right now?
You'd have to view, say, Erdogan and the public's anti-Semitic and pro-Islamist, in many cases, sympathies as much more enduring and much more troublesome than, say, the political expediency that would be behind making a deal along these lines. You actually say this deal is not going to last, that this is doomed. Maybe you could just talk about more of the warning signs, why this is something that we shouldn't expect to see last.
Well, I think the fact that Erdogan could have reconciled with Israel real easy over the past 3 years. 3 years ago, when they said, yes, let's normalize ties, he could have dropped his demand like he has done right now for the blockade to be ended. And they would have had a deal three years ago. That would have been easy, but he didn't. Why didn't he? Because he was in a strong enough position that he did not want to have a deal with Israel unless he really, really has to, and his back's against the wall. So what's right now? So that's why he's got a deal. What happens when he does benefit from some trade with Israel? Perhaps the Syrian crisis stops. Maybe Russia does help Turkey out, and they are doing a little bit better. I mean, if their back's not against the wall, why would they want to continue this relationship with Israel? Turkey has championed themselves next to Iran as one of the leaders throughout the Middle East of nations that don't like Israel, that they're going to support the Palestinian cause. And the Palestinian cause is still a big drawing card through the Middle East. Erdogan wants to be the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire once again. And if he can prove that he is upholding the Palestinian cause, a lot of the Middle Eastern nations and populaces, they will back him in that. Now, there is a danger looking forward, of course, like I say, if they decide at some point that they have what they need. But in the immediate term, I think the big danger is that out of this, Hamas, the terrorist organization, the Gaza Strip, is going to gain power. That I say that because Hamas's headquarters, at least for their political wing, as they call it, has been located in Turkey for the past few years. While we talk about Iran backing Hamas, they do tend to do that when it comes down to the blatant military actions. But Turkey has been backing Hamas for a number of years now. And part of the deal that Israel wanted to get was for Turkey to completely renounce Hamas and to boot all the Hamas members outside of Turkey. They didn't get that. That should be a warning sign. Turkey did not let go of the political wing of Hamas. They are keeping on allowing them to live there. They said they're not going to allow them to direct military actions against Israel from Turkey, but that's the only concession they could get. Turkey wasn't willing to give up its relationship with Hamas, which should be a strong warning sign to Israel of how they really feel about the Jewish state.
Turkey is a country that factors heavily into end-time biblical prophecy. Can you help us to understand and to put this in that context of what we can expect to see from a prophecy standpoint?
There are a couple of prophecies that we could talk about that's actually mentioned in a number of different books, actually. The Turkish nation comes from biblical Esau, or he's known as Edom. And there are a number of prophecies in the book of Obadiah specifically that talk about how that when Israel or when Judah in this end time is trying to escape from armies from a European power, that that Turkey actually sides with the European power and kind of stabs the Jews in the back and turns them over as they are trying to escape to the European power. So that's one way to know that this isn't going to end well. But it also shows that there is going to be a closer relationship with Turkey and Israel so that they can fulfill that prophecy of turning the Jews over. There is also the prophecy in Psalm 83 that we've talked about as well. We know that that alliance with other Arab states, including then Germany from Europe, they are going to be used to destroy Israel as well. So in both of those prophecies, we see that Turkey is not going to change its stripes when it comes to how it feels about Israel.
Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. He's written an article called Why the Israel-Turkey Détente is Doomed. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Brent.
No problem. Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The day of the Brexit referendum last Thursday, it was also an important Supreme Court case decided here in America. And the Supreme Court split 4-4 on the constitutionality of President Barack Obama's executive action in 2014, suspending immigration enforcement for millions of illegal immigrants. And the fact that the court split evenly means that a lower court ruling that it was unconstitutional stands. It was a real defeat for the president in that sense. We're going to talk about this now with trumpet writer Andrew Miller, who's here in the studio. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
It's kind of nice, I have to say, to just be looking at somebody face-to-face rather than through a computer screen.
Right, yeah.
These interviews. But let's just start by talking about what President Obama did back in 2014 that these courts were ruling on.
Right. Yeah. Just to review, we had a couple months ago was actually our cover story on the Trump on the Rise of the Super President, where we had like an entire section of that article just really summarizing what President Obama did in November of 2014, where he proposed immigration reform to Congress. Congress basically got back to him and said, no, we think our current immigration laws are fine. Why don't you start with enforcing those and get back to us if it doesn't work out well? And so he was quite upset that Congress didn't pass this new bill he'd wanted them to pass. And so he used the excuse. I think it's pretty much an exact quote that if Congress won't act, I will. And instructed the Department of Homeland Security to just stop deporting like 4 million illegal immigrants who were scheduled for deportation, which caused a bit of like a political crisis at the time, just trying to decide as like, does the U.S. president really have the power to just make up a law or instruct the executive branch to not enforce laws that Congress has already passed?
Yeah, really showing a contempt for the balance of powers that were established from the founding of the nation in a way that we hadn't seen before.
Right. Well, there definitely is. And just Article 2 of the Constitution on the executive branch, where it says the president shall take care to faithfully execute the laws. It's called the Take Care Clause. And it's really, at the time, Congress wasn't able to do much about it. He just kind of sidestepped them and did what he wanted to anyway. But the state of Texas, and actually 25 of the other states, challenged this as a violation of America's immigration laws. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the law as illegal. Now, granted, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals only has jurisdiction over Louisiana, Texas, and I think Mississippi, one other state. But the Obama administration appealed that decision, and it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, which was what happened on June 23rd, the day of the Brexit referendum. They made the decision where Anton Scalia's been dead, we don't have nine justices right now. They haven't appointed the ninth one, and so it's an even number of judges, eight. So I guess four of them ruled that this was illegal and four of them ruled that it was legal, which basically just puts the entire issue on ice. It's not a decision. They actually don't even have to reveal which four justices voted which way, although it doesn't take Sherlock Holmes to guess. Mm-hmm. But it's a divided decision. The lower court ruling stands unless, obviously, the federal government wants to challenge it again. Once they've got their ninth justice, and then they'll resolve it at that point.
It's pretty remarkable that four Supreme Court justices viewed this kind of executive overreach as being constitutional.
No, it is amazing. I actually have a quote here from Texas's official complaint where it says, "This lawsuit is not about immigration. It's about the rule of law, presidential power, and the structural limits of the U.S. Constitution." So whether you're a supporter of amnesty for illegal immigrants or whether you oppose amnesty for illegal immigrants really isn't the issue here. The issue is that can the president sidestep Congress in granting that type of amnesty?
Yeah, what purpose does Congress serve if not to fulfill its constitutionally mandated responsibility in determining the legality of these types of things and ruling on them and passing them? If the president is able to just do what he wants to do, regardless of their weighing in on it, then it kind of nullifies their viability as an entity.
Right. And I mean, that is really the huge danger of when this case is retried. As I think President Obama gave his speech this week about how the Supreme Court's decision was heartbreaking and infants are going to be torn from their mother's arms as they're deported, which doesn't actually happen. That no federal agent tears an infant from its mother's arms. I mean, if someone came here illegally and had a child, that child does have U.S. citizens because it was born here. But being a minor, the mother would have the right of her own to decide whether she wants to take it with her back to Mexico or whether she has relatives in the United States she'd rather it stay with. But he's really trying to pull on people's emotions there to see that it's like, try to get immigration supporters to support this, but it is really almost kind of sidestepping the major issue here. They realize that if this goes through and this is set as a precedent in U.S. judicial law, I mean, even if you're an Obama supporter, what's to stop, say, Donald Trump, if he's the next president of the United States, from using similar powers for tax reform or something liberals would oppose. I mean, it really does get into where the checks and balances would be eroded away, and all a president would need to enact legislation would be 50% of the people plus one to have voted for him in the first place.
You have studied his presidency quite a lot from a legal perspective, and just examining his moves, just the areas where he has exceeded his constitutional responsibility. Where would you rank this move, this 2014 move that he made, say, in that among those actions that he's taken, in terms of just how far over the line he stepped?
I'd rank it first and foremost amongst all the moves. I mean, he did point some Senate recess appointments that the Supreme Court struck down as unconstitutional, though that was more of a technicality type thing. Also, the war in Libya, he got UN authorization for that, but never got congressional authorization. I don't think the court ever ruled on that, though I think most constitutional originalists would point to the fact that the president can't just go to war without getting congressional authorization. Congress is actually supposed to declare war. I mean, that hasn't happened since World War II, but you still, since Vietnam, they've had a provision that if they don't want to declare emergency war powers, if a conflict lasts longer than 45 days, he's supposed to get Congress to sign off on it. So, I mean, you could make a very long list of the constitutional violations of the Obama administration, and some of them are technicalities, some of them are more serious. But this, this is kind of even like the English Civil War and even the American Revolution were all about. Probably most Americans don't know much of the English Civil War, but that's in 1689, the English did their version of the Bill of Rights, which was strongly our version of the Bill of Rights. And first and foremost of their claims against King James II at the time, as they said, a king enacting a law by regal authority without consent of Parliament is illegal. And then about 100 years after that happened in America, we kind of had to fight that battle out all over again when George III tried to do the same thing that James II was and start either suspending or enacting laws without any local legislator giving him the consent to do that. And this is something that even President Obama's statement that he says, like, when Congress won't act, I will, is not true. Congress did act. We have immigration laws.
Right.
They're on the books. He just didn't like them.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, the level of disrespect for what the founders established and the reasoning behind three branches of government that had very specifically enumerated powers to check the other branches of government. There was a lot of reasoning, a lot of strong logic behind that. There was a reason why they did that, in order to prevent the kind of tyrannical moves that you see in so many other countries. I mean, that legal tradition that you see in Britain that made its way over here and really found its finest form in history in this country is being trampled on in an extraordinary way. And the fact that you have the president overriding Congress the way he has, and I still find it just extraordinary that basically half of the Supreme Court right now is on the president's side in this case. What does that tell you about America today?
Right. And I mean, that is a tricky part is that probably most people wouldn't know this, but I guess to use an extreme example is under like Stalin in the Soviet Union, there was an executive branch, there was a judicial branch, and there was a legislative branch. And they had very similar checks and balances on each other, the United States Constitution. Key difference was that obviously communist Russia was a one-party state, so the same political party controlled all three branches of government. I think there was even a time when Stalin didn't even hold an official government office, except that he was the leader of the Communist Party. And so if there was ever a dispute between like the executive branch and the judicial branch, you just go to Stalin and he'll make both sides do what he wants. That is a tricky part with the U.S. Constitution was designed to prevent a tyrant or an oligarchy or a minority from hijacking the government. It has no provisions, though, to really stop an out-of-control majority. I mean, if the majority of the American people want to put immigration reform above the constitutional checks and balances,
or they want to say something like not enforcing the laws on the books. If you're going to put someone in office who basically says to everybody under his authority, look, don't enforce this law.
Right. And I'm not claiming that the majority of the American people do want that. But like I said, if you've got, I guess, like a political party like the Democratic Party, that they've got a hold on the presidency and at least enough support in the Supreme Court and Congress to block those checks and balances, which is fairly much as what's happened is, I mean, we have a president who wants to circumvent the legislator. Normally, according to the checks and balances, the court is supposed to stop him. But if you have four judges who think just like the president, regardless of what the Constitution says, the court can no longer stop him. So that we actually have a second check that would help that. If the court doesn't stop him, Congress is supposed to stop the court by sacking the judge. But it's difficult for Congress to sack it. It takes a two-thirds majority in both houses to sack a judge. Hmm. And so if you don't have that two-thirds, if you've got like the same political party has enough support in Congress, the courts, and the executive branch, the checks and balances don't actually work like mm-hmm. they were hoped to.
Well, it definitely, this has to be the most high-profile instance that shows how important the appointment to the Supreme Court is going to be in order to replace Antonin Scalia's seat. I mean, this really does have to kind of weigh into the whole presidential campaign when you look at who the next president is going to be and who is going to be empowered to replace him. You know, it could have a huge impact on these kinds of cases.
Right. And President Obama himself has admitted that, where he said that this happened because the Republicans have refused to appoint the judicial nominee I put forward. They're waiting till the next election. So he said it's really kind of in the American people's court now, whether who they're going to, November they'll elect a new president, they'll elect a new Congress. That president and that Congress will decide who this new Supreme Court judge is. And if you've gotten, and that Supreme Court judge will be the tiebreaker to decide whether we want an executive branch that can rule by regal decree or whether we actually still want Congress to be involved in the lawmaking process in some way.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's working on an article on this subject, and that will be available in the coming days on thetrumpet.com. Andrew, fascinating to talk with you.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Last week, Britain had what it called its Independence Day. Next Monday, Americans will be celebrating the 240th anniversary of its independence. But in both of these nations, there's a lot of deeply concerning news, a lot of evidence, in fact, that darkness is descending on the long, historically extraordinary Anglo-American age. Britain, once a globe-girding empire, is certain to struggle on its own after decades of being bullied by a growing European superstate. America, which was once the greatest superpower on earth, is battered and it's losing its global influence. History teaches that world orders don't last. They come and go. This present one is giving way to something very different, and it truly will be the world's loss. However, Britain and America's brightest days are not history. Glowing within their remarkable past is the promise of a far more luminous future. The British and the Americans have long believed that they were duty-bound, even destined, to lead the world. Kirk Emmert wrote in his book Winston S. Churchill on Empire, The glory of the British Empire was its service to a cause that transcended Britain, that transcended history, that transcended time itself. And that cause was to lift human life away from barbarism and savagery towards civilization and human excellence. Churchill passionately devoted himself to promoting that empire. He considered the fostering of civilization as its highest purpose. He wrote that empire civilizes both the ruled and their rulers. The United States founders sought to establish a lasting beacon of liberty and democracy to the nations. Lyman Beecher said that the nation was destined to lead the way in the moral and political emancipation of the world. Abraham Lincoln said that America must ensure that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. And ever since America entered World War II, it has essentially served as the guarantor of peace in the world. Now, naturally, all such human efforts are imperfect, but really, until recently, the fruits of the Anglo-American effort to benefit mankind have been more sweet than bitter. The prophecies of the Bible reveal that there's an awesome reason for this, and it's one that points back to ancient history, and yet it also illuminates an inspiring future. You can read about it in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. We'd be happy to send you a free copy. The reason is that these nations are the modern descendants of ancient Israel. The Bible shows that Israel was given a tremendous responsibility. God chose this nation to represent him and to set an example for the rest of the world. Biblical history and prophecy show that God still intends for Israel's descendants to fulfill this glorious purpose. When John Winthrop spoke of America as a city on a hill in 1630, he issued this warning: "We must consider that we will be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world." Now, really, this is where Britain and America find themselves today, and it's going to get worse. The sun is setting on Anglo-American dominance. And when these nations fall, the world will plunge back into the blackness of barbarism and savagery. But the Bible that prophesied this fall also tells us that Britain and America's brightest days are yet to come. Jeremiah 33 depicts a time yet future after America and Britain have endured a nightmarish tribulation that is intended to correct them for their sins. And it contains God's promises to restore to them fantastic prosperity and to make them a positive example. They will become, it says, a praise and an honor before all the nations of the earth. And God is promising not only to restore these nations to fantastic prosperity, but also to help them become the positive example that they have always struggled and failed to be. But it won't be Pax Americana or the British Empire that these peoples will be promoting. It'll be the peace of God and the kingdom of God. The King of Kings will lift all human life towards civilization and excellence. And Britain and America, finally, will submit to him, and they'll become the beautiful, godly nations that they were always intended to be. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. We do want to hear your thoughts on the program. If you just email us at letters@thetrumpet.com, we'd be happy to hear from you. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Andrew Miller. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with this thought from James Madison. "It is the duty of every man to render homage to the Creator. This duty is precedent both in order of time and degree of obligation to the claims of civil society. Before any man can be considered as a member of civil society, he must be considered as a subject of the governor of the universe. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.